Well, this is an anniversary of sorts. I'm not sure it's one worth celebrating today, but it was 162 years ago today that Preston Brooks clobbered Charles Sumner over the head with a cane in Congress. Certainly the most egregious incident of violence in congressional history, I would assume.
Yeah, well, it was in a sense the most deliberate and thus for that reason even more shocking violent incident because, you know, Brooks came with the cane and sort of walked over to Sumner's desk and very deliberately struck him down. And so, you know, there have been many other things have happened in Congress that are violent, but few of them are kind of that deliberately brutal.
You know, I believe Thomas Hart Benton had a gun pulled on him and pointed on him in the middle of a congressional session. What were some of the other memorable incidents?
Well, there was an incident in the 1840s, actually, when John Quincy Adams was in the House, and an argument got out of control, and it became kind of a mass brawl, and someone ran onto the floor who wasn't in Congress and shot off a gun, which didn't hit anyone in Congress, but apparently hit a Capitol Police officer in the leg. So that one was a little shocking. I think maybe the most shocking one took place in 1858, and obviously that's getting awfully close to the Civil War. And in that case, people at the time recognized that whereas in the past you had maybe clusters of men fighting or one man fighting another, this was a group of Southerners and a group of Northerners who ended up running at each other in the House of Representatives, and they were armed. So this was people defined it as a battle of North against South. This is a couple of years before the Civil War, but it's kind of striking that in that way, Congress is representative, truly, if the people in Congress were literally breaking down to that level of violence and conflict.
Your new book is called The Field of Blood, Violence in Congress and the Road to the Civil War. When did we first begin to see debate spin out of control and into aggressive acts?
Well, there's random aggressive acts that go all the way back to, I mean, maybe the first one I can think of is 1798. I think someone challenged someone to a duel a little before that, but it gets really more violent beginning in the 1830s and then particularly in the 1840s and 1850s. And part of the reason for that is actually the press. When I first started this project and I was looking around in congressmen's papers, I noticed an uptake, you know, sort of an upswing in people punching each other or people worried about what people would think about them. And when I poked around a little bit more, what I discovered is that the press was becoming more efficient. It was becoming more widespread in the 1830s, and so the audience was getting more immediate and bigger. And I think that, you know, if you think about it, if democracy is a conversation between rulers and ruled, if the conversation changes, then the nature of democracy changes. And so I think it was technological changes in part that helped whatever already was brewing as a problem become more violent.
Well, it certainly seems like the polarization is pretty bad today. How does what we're seeing, and not just in Congress, but in the media, in our public conversations, how does it compare to the bad old days of the 1840s and 1850s?
Well, you know, it's interesting. So I think about that a lot, which is not surprising. And I end up being of two minds. So on the one hand, you know, my first book was on the 1790s. So if you look over the really long haul, you can say in the late 1790s, in the 1850s, in the 1960s, and now, all of those moments have been moments of extreme polarization, some degree of violence, growing distrust of national institutions, the press sort of pumping conspiracy theories of various sorts. I mean, there are things that happen in clusters that do not do great favors probably to any country, but in particularly to the United States. So in that sense, like one of those two minds says, okay, well, we are falling into a pattern that we've fallen into before. But that said, you know, as a historian, I can't say history just repeats, right? History echoes, but it doesn't repeat.
Right.
And so by that, I mean the fact that what we're experiencing now, that we've had echoes of that in the past, is significant, and we should learn from that. But it doesn't mean that I necessarily know at all what's going on now or what's going to happen next. You know, we're in some ways in distinct territory now. So, you know, it's, I guess history sort of gives you that kind of perspective and points out to you what's old and what's new.
We're talking with historian Joanne Freeman here on Downtown. It's important to note, too, that while patterns are sometimes the same, the specifics change, and even in regard to our political parties, they've undergone dramatic transformation in the last 150 years, and the parties that we think of as Democratic and Republican today don't reflect the core values they had back in the mid-1800s.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and that's a hard thing, I think, for some people to grab onto, is that because the name is the same, right? So you look in 1855 and you see Democrat versus Republican, and you say, well, we could go all the way back to the late 1850s and see Democrat versus Republican. But the names are the same, but the ideologies and the purposes and the politics and the policies and the context are entirely different. So parties change dramatically over time, and they put together and sort of pull apart things that you would not imagine being together within one party or apart within one party. So, for example, in my early days of being a historian, when I was doing a lot of work that had to do with Alexander Hamilton, right, he's a Federalist. So people at the time said, well, he's a conservative, right? He was a guy who was all about law and order, and he wasn't comfortable with democracy. It's like, yeah, he was a conservative, and he was in favor of big government. So those two things, they don't go together now, right? But they did in 1795. So you can't draw straight lines from the present to the past as much as people want to. And, of course, they want to because they want to claim a particular political heritage, and people have been doing that since the dawn of the Republic. But as far as it sort of reasonably, you know, realistically reflecting the essence of a party, it doesn't really tell you very much.
Well, you brought up Alexander Hamilton, and you have been researching him, studying him, writing about him since you were back in high school. What was it that made his story compelling to you as a young woman? And if I've got my timeline right, back in the bicentennial year when you first discovered and embraced Alexander Hamilton?
Yeah, it was partly the bicentennial. So, you know, I know a number of historians, early American historians, who their interest was sparked by the bicentennial. So I kind of think maybe some people will be motivated by our current Hamilton mania moment to actually go off and read history and sort of get into history. But as far as I'm concerned, I think the bicentennial got me interested. Actually, I think the movie 1776 got me interested, too. I was about, I don't know, 14 years old or something. And I started reading biographies. And a lot of the biographies I read, I liked. But they, you know, like I read about John Adams, who's fascinating, and but a lot had been written about him. I think I read a book about Richard Henry Lee of Virginia. I read any number of books, and it felt to me as though what needed to be said about those people had been said. And I read, there weren't a lot of biographies of Hamilton, and I read one, and I actually didn't believe it. It didn't make sense to me somehow. Like, I wish I could recreate in my mind whatever the heck it was that made me think that. But somehow Hamilton seemed to me like there was a lot of mystery to him, that people hadn't figured him out, that people hadn't really seemed to have delved into who he was. I went to the library with a book I didn't like, and I said, what did this guy who wrote this book read so that he could write this book? And so the librarian pointed me to the 27 volumes of Hamilton's published papers, and I started reading his letters. And that was that for me. That was, like, to me, the real stuff, right? That was, like, the mainlining history, right? I was like, ooh, like, that's it. There it is. Like, I don't need someone else's book. And, you know, if you read someone's personal letters and private correspondence and public papers for a while, I mean, a long while, you start to understand how that person thinks. And you start to begin to understand, because this person's a politician, their politics as well. So over the decades, I built up a really great understanding of who this guy was and his pluses and minuses and the many ways in which his politics and personality were extreme, but nobody knew who the guy was. So, you know, I would do a lot of public lecturing, and I would tell people, you know, he's a founder too. You should let him be a founder too, because, you know, he was in the mix. Now I walk around and I say to people, he's not so great. He's not as great as you think.
Now, when you heard that Lin-Manuel Miranda was working on a musical about Hamilton, you reached out to him. You thought it was important to make sure that Hamilton's words were part of this story.
Well, exactly. So I heard that this was happening, I knew that Ron Chernow's biography was going to be at the core of it, and I logically enough thought, probably there's not going to be a second musical about Alexander Hamilton, so if this is his moment, his own words have to get in it somehow. His own words need to be part of this play. So yeah, I've found a way to get a hold of Lin Miranda and hand him an edited volume from the Library of America that I did of Hamilton's writings, and with that message, just put Hamilton's words in the show, you know, put the actual person in the show. So, which he did. There's actually direct quotes from a lot of the letters are either directly taken and put in the show or changed very little and put in the show. So that was gratifying to me that there was, you know, some of the actual Hamiltonian language in there.
I love that you mentioned 1776. We had Bill Daniels on the show a while back, who played John Adams both in the stage production and in the movie version of 1776, and says, despite everything he's done, from being Dustin Hoffman's dad in The Graduate to a number of TV shows, St. Elsewhere and others, it's still John Adams that people talk to him the most about.
Yeah, no, he was amazing as John Adams. I mean, I think when I was a kid, he was kind of a hero because he was so wonderful as John Adams in that film. I didn't get to see the play, but in the movie, for sure. And I think later he played John Quincy Adams.
Yes, he did. That's right.
Yeah, I was going to say, because then he became a double whammy Adams for me. He was like both Adams for me. But that doesn't surprise me. And I think, unfortunately, if he's trying to get out of the Adams shadow, given where we are now, I don't think he's going to do that.
Joanne, talk a little bit, if you can, about the Backstory podcast, which I've just fallen in love with. It's wonderfully entertaining and informative.
Well, thank you. It's wonderfully fun to do. It's four historians, all with different areas of specialization. So I'm an early Americanist. There's Ed Ayers, who is a 19th century historian. And then there's Brian Ballow and Nathan Connolly, who are 20th century historians. And from week to week, we pick some sort of issue that's vaguely connected to what's going on in the news, or some event that's happening, or a holiday, or something, some kind of a trend. And we talk about, appropriately enough, the backstory. You know, we sort of look about how this played out over time, what are the roots of this thing. We find interesting stories that get into the sort of deeper realities of things. And what I love about the podcast particularly is that a lot of it is us sort of bouncing ideas off of each other and talking to each other and learning from each other, so that I just love the process of doing the podcast. And I think the end result, really, you can hear how much we're enjoying doing it. And I think that probably makes it more enjoyable to listen to.
I think you're an absolutely wonderful follow on Twitter. And I saw a comment that you posted, I think it was last week, and maybe was it from Lin-Manuel Miranda, who talked about how you were unsure of what to do on Twitter early on, like so many people. And now you've become a superstar. You're tremendous out there.
Well, I don't know if I'm a superstar, but I definitely am a late adapter of technology, for sure. So I'm the last person to, as soon as I pick up on the technology, for sure, the next week it's going to be gone. Right? It'll be like, oh, no one's using that anymore. But I took a workshop a couple of years back, actually this wonderful project called the Op-Ed Project that is aimed at diversifying the kinds of people that do op-eds and speak out in the public sphere. So one of the things they said was, you got to be out in the public, open a Twitter account. And I thought, yeah, okay, sure. I opened a Twitter account. I can't say I did very much with it for very long. But over the years, I've actually kind of become fond of, and now, actually, in the last 2 years, I'm beginning to feel as though it's quite important, particularly for historians, to find every way that they can possibly find to talk to the public, to link to the public, to talk about American history, to talk about American traditions of governance, to talk about the roots of a lot of things that right now are being questioned or prodded or poked. So, you know, I now kind of, it doesn't go together with a phrase, but I was going to say, I sort of feel sometimes like I have a Twitter mission. I need to pump history out in any way I can to the public, and that has become one way. One of the earliest people that I tweeted to happened to be Lin Miranda, because he was one of two people that I knew happened to be on Twitter. And so, yeah, sometime in the last week or two, I happened to be at an event that he happened to be at, and he said, you've got to be quite something there on Twitter. I thought, ooh, he's the king of Twitter, so if he's saying that, then I must have somehow accomplish something.
So before we let you go, these are challenging times here in America. And so using history as a guide, what can make us confident that we'll come out of this dark period right now and find that light again, and tell us why the Constitution can survive even the toughest times?
Well, right. I mean, I can't say I know, obviously, what's going to happen. What I can say is the Constitution, as it was created by the framers, was seen as a sort of touch base, like a touchstone, so that no matter how weird things got, you could always find your way back to the Constitution. So, for example, when people were afraid that civil war might break out in the presidential election of 1800 because it was so polarized and people really did or didn't want Thomas Jefferson to be president, in letters afterwards, Jefferson said, well, you know, even if things had gone haywire, the fact is we would have had some kind of a convention or meeting and gone back to the Constitution and fixed things up, and we would be right back with the Constitution. So the idea of putting a Constitution in writing and really putting in writing in a very specific way the framework of government and putting in there, you know, the process so that you can amend it, but still having a basic framework put on paper, the intention was for that to be always a kind of guiding force. Now, what we're learning now is the many, many ways in which norms that are not in the Constitution have been propping that Constitution up, and when some of those norms are violated, it suddenly becomes quite interesting as to what is or isn't constitutional, and that's a lot of what we're talking about these days. So, you know, my thought is people need to understand the importance of the Constitution and its role and why it's important to think about what it says and not just to cast it aside, because if nothing else, it really was the foundation of this kind of participatory government grounded on public opinion and the American public in a way that governments weren't at that time. You know, it really was a venturing off of what people were doing. It was a world of monarchies. And I feel that people need to remain invested in that idea.
Joanne Freeman, the author of the upcoming book, The Field of Blood, Violence in Congress and the Road to Civil War. Check out as well Affairs of Honor, The Essential Hamilton. Subscribe to Backstory Radio, for goodness sakes, it'll make you a better person. And by the way, before we let you go, thanks so much for getting us together with your brother Mark, who is also tremendously talented and was a great guest.
Oh, I love that. It was my absolute pleasure. I love my brother, and I love the fact that he has also been on your show.
Well, nothing but the best here. That's the way we look at it. Joanne, thank you so much for being with us this afternoon. We look forward to talking with you again down the road.